The Word of Mouth Daily Podcast is brought to you by
Doucette Survey,
serving your professional land surveying and mapping needs in New England,
now with offices in New Hampshire and Maine.
Information at doucetsurvey.com. That's doucetsurvey.com. And
Dartmouth Hitchcock,
creating a new model for healthcare,
where leading health systems collaborate to improve care for all of us.
A sustainable system
improving the health of our communities
for years to come.
Information at imagine.d-h. Org.
Word of mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Almost everyone has a variation of this, a battered shoebox squirreled away in the closet that keeps the past hidden. The faded photographs, old love letters, plastic treasures from a childhood trip to the fair, relics of a past that we're not quite ready to let go of, but don't necessarily want to see out in the open. Some of those mementos and reminders are being usurped by social media algorithms that foist memories, and especially photographs from the past, good or bad, back to the surface. It's an experience that can be jarring, invasive, and sometimes even painful. In an essay for the Boston Globe Ideas section, the writer Charlotte Litton says that social media functions as a conveyor belt of bite-sized nostalgia and memories, offering little choice to forget. Charlotte, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thanks for being with us. So what is an example of social media reanimating memories that people might want to avoid?
So a key one I discuss in the piece is that of a young girl whose father was an active social media user. And last year, Facebook rolled out a feature called Year in Review. And that was passing together some key moments from that Facebook user's year. For this particular Facebook user, however, when it showed a picture of his six-year-old daughter who had died, unfortunately, having her face transposed against a background of balloons and ribbons and other celebratory things felt very jarring and obviously upsetting. Now, that was something that appeared on his page. He didn't click anything to warrant that coming. So it was really a shock. And as you can imagine, social media plays such a big part in so many people's lives nowadays, but we don't really think about the fact that sometimes those positive memories might turn sour eventually.
Right. And these images get spat up by an algorithm that just generates, you know, you got more likes on this than anybody else, whether it is a former partner or somebody who's deceased. What to you is this nostalgia and the role that it serves in social media?
Well, what I'd argue is that we don't really have nostalgia anymore because we don't really get much distance from our memories. As you mentioned at the beginning of this show, we used to have things like shoeboxes or places that were really finite where we could put our memories and store them and revisit them when we wanted to. Nowadays, you click on your phone, you open a folder on your computer, and you're kind of flooded or bombarded with all these other images or other mementos that you've taken over the years, because we haven't quite learned how to archive things digitally in the same way we would do with personal items, tangible things that we can hold. And so re-nostalgia, we don't have that same sense of distance. Things are always with us, so we can't really move away from them. And that, I think, is one of the key things social media throws up for us now, and one of its real challenges that we're just learning to grapple with.
So it seems to me like a sort of enforced nostalgia. It's pushing things at you that you're supposed to miss. But you're saying we need a little distance. We need a little room to be able to forget.
Right. I feel like I can envisage every photo, every moment that I've taken. Say I've been using Facebook for about 6 years. You know, those photos all seem very fresh to me. I don't really have distance from them. I can't really miss things that happened 6 years ago because those photos are always coming back on some kind of revisiting feature that Facebook runs or that Twitter runs. And so it's hard to really move away from that and really enjoy the things nostalgia can give you because, you know, it's really nice when you pick out an old photo album at your parents' house and see those memories from 20 years ago that you really don't get a chance to revisit often. However, with social media, because it is 24/7 and it's relentless, we have everything at our fingertips all of the time. And I think for that reason, we don't really get to miss things or move on from them.
It's interesting you say that. I've been cleaning out my parents' house for sale and originally feeling very nostalgic, each photo seemed very precious, or each letter or each handmade card. It grew less and less precious as I opened each new box of new material. I'm wondering if there's the same kind of effect on Facebook. You know, you're getting photographs and images via fire hose. Things don't seem as special.
Absolutely. And with things like photo albums or shoeboxes, there's only so much space. You couldn't stuff them full of hundreds of endless photos. You know, you had to really choose what meant something to you and put that somewhere and keep it there. And so, as you mentioned there, the more and more you see these things, the less special they feel. And that's the kind of relationship I think we're having with social media, whereby there's just so much that it gets hard to kind of become sentimentally attached to things and to really appreciate them.
Well, also, I suppose with those boxes hidden away, you could control your intake. You could choose to go in. You could choose to excavate and find these pieces of the past. I'm wondering if that's an illusion in itself. You know, memories exist whether we excavate them or not.
They do, but I think the nature of things now is that this idea of them being unenforced, that them just happening to us and then being foisted upon us, happens far more frequently. You're never going to totally avoid these random reoccurrences of old memories, but the amount of our lives that we put online means that we have all these algorithms working for us and working through our personal business in many ways. And so that just leads to a whole world of possible encounters or resurgences of moments past.
Well, it's funny to watch the evolution of these throwback Thursdays. Initially, it seemed to be really old pictures of grade school or high school. Now they refer to things that happened just 8 months ago. I mean, is there just too much information to remember back too far?
I think it's a combination of things. I think that's possibly one of those things. For example, if you do Throwback Thursday every single week, naturally, there are fewer photos of people in the early years. But I also think that social media really invites a positive spin on things. You know, there are very few people who post the real dark things and would take photos saying, oh gosh, I had a horrible day. You know, we share things that make us happy, that we think are positive, that we feel comfortable sharing with others. And I think that's why we see so many of these alleged archive photos that really are from very recent history.
It's funny that we get so many examples of this almost obsession with wanting to remember the past, moments of the past, images of the past, while wanting to forget the painful ones. How are we going to strike that balance when everything is going to be posted on our timelines?
I think that's a really interesting question. And I think that's something that's really going to be dictated by the social media giants we have. I mean, we totally play into their mainframe and we're kind of at their whim, really, at their mercy. We use our social media profiles in the way that they want users to use them. So that's Facebook and Twitter and Instagram. And I think there will come a stage where, when those companies are older, when more people have fallen victim to some of the really difficult things that they can throw up, that those companies will realize that something needs to be done. Once that happens to enough people, I think companies like Facebook will start paying attention and think, we have to do something to protect people in their digital futures. Because if everybody thinks, oh, well, if I post anything nice that eventually turns sour, it will come back to haunt me, I don't think they'd use these sites so freely. Eventually, if it happens to enough people who are vocal enough about it, I think they will. Like you say, there is a huge amount of money to be made in nostalgia and in picking up things from our past that are happy to look at.
Well, Charlotte, thank you for speaking with us.
No problem at all. Thank you for having me.
Charlotte Litton, she's a journalist. She's based in London. And we found her article, Social Media Killed Nostalgia, in the idea section of the Boston Globe. You'll find a link to read it for yourself. It's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Campfire songs, hiking, canoeing, first crushes, vaguely Native American-themed games, they are all quintessential summer camp experiences. Now iPhones are increasingly being packed along with the bug spray and sneakers as kids set off for sleepaway summer camp, the place where enjoying the natural world is supposed to be the chief activity. Brett Burke joins us now to talk about how smartphones are ruining the free-range life at summer camp. And Brett, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
So what was summer camp like for you as a kid?
You know, I went to summer camp in the 70s and 80s. And if you've seen any of the movies that are reflective of that experience during that period, like Little Darlings or Meatballs or Friday the 13th, it was a somewhat milder version of that.
But still sound wild?
It was relatively wild. I mean, it was, you know, I think the youth of that era had sort of appropriated all of the revolutionary jargon and liberation of the, you know, liberation movements that happened in the 60s and early 70s. And so we were sort of, you know, separate from adult power. Any sort of adult infringement on our sense of self was, you know, seen as something to oppose, you know, like fighting the man.
Did you ever call your parents when you were at sleepaway camp?
Call my parents?
Yeah.
No. That's a shocking question. How could that have even happened? I don't even know if there was a phone at my camp. There was an issue one time when my brother went to camp with me as well, and he broke a bone, something in his hand or his arm, and the camp had to call my mother at some point to either clarify some insurance information or deal with some sort of medical thing. This was after the bone had been set, and they called her, and they were like, oh, you know, we just want to clarify the insurance information. And she was like, well, can I talk to him? And she wanted to talk to him basically to find out if he was okay to stick around for the second session of camp, the second month of camp. And they were like, oh, you know, it's against camp policy to talk to campers. And anyway, how would we know which one he is? And my mom was like, he's the one with the cast. But there was no other, there wasn't communication in the other direction. You certainly never talked to your parents at camp. You could fill out one of those sort of Mad Lib style letters or whatever that you would try to send home in the hope that perhaps someone would respond with candy or some sort of other illicit substance. But there was definitely no communication from child to parent via the phone.
Well, now kids are packing their cell phones and iPhones to some camps. Some of them actually ban them. It's a bit more structured and a bit more tame, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's a variety of different things going on here. You know, I'm a child development person, you know, and I wrote a parenting book and have all of this experience with dealing with kids and families. From that perspective, I think what we're seeing sort of this interesting confluence of things where there's the ability to have constant supervision and connection to your child, or at least, you know, the idea of it, right, that you can be in touch with them at any point, at any place where they might be. Given that, people come to expect and rely upon that, the idea of that existing. When you're used to the notion that you are always able to be in touch with your child, the idea of being out of touch with your child is somehow this sort of crazy rupture, right?
Right, but do you think it's the kids then that want the phones, or the parents?
Well, I would say it's the parents, generally. I mean, kids like to have communication. They're used to that, and kids as young as, you know, 9, 8, oftentimes generally have cell phones of their own. But my sense is, from researching this and from looking at, like, the rules and the way that these things are stated in terms of family guidelines and camp handbooks and things like that, you know, it's pretty much, if the camp bans phones, the understanding would be that the parent would probably, being the authority figure in the home, collect the phone before the child goes to camp.
Yeah.
So if a child shows up at camp with a phone, it means the parent has probably neglected to do that duty or has insisted that the child bring the phone to camp. They all have these marginally putative statements that are like, the phone will be returned to your parent at their expense. But my sense is that kids go to camp and they're like involved in whatever is going on in camp. They don't need to know at every moment what's going on. Although I did just today, coincidentally, drop my niece off at camp. She goes to a performing arts camp not too far away from my country house in upstate New York. Mm-hmm. And she said that at her camp, they take away the phone for the first week. And then after that, you can get it out of a lockbox during a certain time period each day or some portion of time during each week. And she was telling me that she had convinced her sister to compose a daily text that would include an Instagram photo from Kim Kardashian's feed, as well as some of her top tweets for that day. And she would send that to her, so she would be able to receive that information.
But, oh, thank goodness she won't miss that.
I know, exactly. And that changes on a day-to-day basis with wild variation, as you can imagine.
Well, you know, the whole purpose of summer camp was I thought anyway, you learn how to be a little bit independent. You wean yourself off your parents. It sounds like in many cases, parents need to wean themselves off their children when they're at summer camp.
Yeah, and I think that's the case with contemporary parenting in general right now. Kids aren't leading the way on a lot of these things. Kids come into the world not really exactly knowing how any of these social organizational skills work, and parents are the ones that teach them. So if parents are demonstrating that the tether needs to be constant and consistent, that's what kids are going to be used to, and that's what they're going to come to expect. You know, I'm not saying that kids don't like to be in touch with their family, but I'm saying that from that developmental perspective, at a time when you would ordinarily be sowing the seeds of your own independence, there is this parental tether that exists now that may not have existed in the past.
So what do you think that does to the experience of summer camp?
I think that in some ways it can diminish that sense of independence and creating your own life. If you're tethered back to your friends and family members at home, then it's harder to, as we all know from any experience, it's harder to then immerse yourself in the culture that's separate or different from that. So I think that there can be some ways in which you can remain connected and tethered to the Kim Kardashian Instagram feed may not be a wonderful example, but to those kinds of things or to familial engagement and to engagement with friends who may not be there. Going to camp for the first time or going to camp at all when you're younger can be a jarring experience. And, you know, you don't want kids to feel abandoned, obviously, or let off. But today, you know, we were leaving my niece at camp. And she had already turned in her cell phone and they had given her claim ticket, you know, or whatever it was. So we were leaving and my partner and I, we were like, okay, bye. We couldn't say like, text us or call us or whatever. And for a moment, it felt strange to just be like walking away without having what comes next. And did you get settled in? Did you put your underwear in the proper drawer? Did any of your bunkmates try to shiv you, you know, or anything like that? Then I was like, she's fine. She's 15 years old. She's at camp. She's been going to camp for years. I'm sure nothing terrible is going to happen. And she needs that sense of independence and that sense of being separated from us.
Well, Brett, thank you very much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's been my pleasure. Thanks so much.
Brett Burke, he's a contributing writer for Vanity Fair and author of The Gay Uncle's Guide to Parenting. And you'll find a link to read his article at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Are you ready for the summer?
Now that everyone's phone has been stowed away, it's time to remember some popular campfire songs. Jeffrey Carpenter spent most of his childhood summers at a church camp in the Colorado Rockies. Every evening, campers gathered around the fire to sing John Denver songs. Then one summer, a counselor revealed what he believed to be the true nature of John Denver. For Jeffrey and his fellow campers, the song Rocky Mountain High would never be the same.
My name is Jeffrey Carpenter, and the most memorable song from childhood for me is Rocky Mountain High by John Denver.
He was born in the summer.
I think it was one of my first vinyl records. And that song in particular, I just love to play over and over and over again. In fact, my brother, he just got tired of listening to the song. And one day he just took the record and cracked it over his knee. My father was a youth minister. Every summer we would take a trip to Colorado to a camp called Frontier Ranch. Their mission was to sort of bring the news of the gospel to young people.
Turn in God's word tonight to Genesis chapter 2.
They would start out by having a music ministry where someone would get up with a guitar and lead songs. And John Denver figured heavily within the music, since, you know, Colorado was his place.
He left yesterday behind him. You might say he was born again. You might say he found the key to every door.
So every night, all the kids would get together and sing songs, and then someone would get up and have a very simple sort of message. Well, this particular evening, whoever it was got up to speak, and it seemed like he was getting something off his chest. I remember there was this pained look on his face as he described this cult-like organization that was anti-Christian. And at the very end of telling us about these terrible people, he unveiled who was at the head of it. And then it was John Denver, who was chairman of the board.
Follow me where I go, what I do, who I know.
And they would no longer be singing John Denver songs. And everybody was like, what? I just remember looking at the album cover. This is so ridiculous. And he's so serene, and he's got such a big smile on his face, and he's the nicest guy in the world. And how could he be evil? But, I mean, they told me it was true, so I believed them, but it didn't make me stop loving his music.
The Colorado Rocky Mountain High.
I find it almost another universe and another life that I would even think that somebody is all evil or all good. It's only funny to me now.
Rocky Mountain High. Colorado, Rocky Mountain High.
That story was told by Jeffrey Carpenter for the Song and Memory series. Imagine a world without work, where machines slog through the menial, messy, and tiring work without complaint, leaving people free to do whatever they choose, play music, make their own food or furniture, write stories, teach, anything in place of what they now have to do. Sounds like a version of utopia or a setup for science fiction. But given the number of jobs now being automated, that leisure-filled world may be less futuristic than you might think. Derek Thompson, senior editor for The Atlantic, explored what a post-job society might look like and how we might get ready for a world without work. Derek Thompson, welcome to Word of Mouth.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, this is a long story of human progress being marked by creating machines, replacing human toil. So where are we in that progression now?
This is a process that's been going on probably since the first time a caveman fashioned a handsaw. That was maybe, the first element of technology that saved them some amount of time. But, the modern economy today is the outcome of lots of technological growth. We were an agrarian economy, and then technology moved us off the farms into factories, and technology moved us out of the factories into a service economy. And the thought here is that we're beginning to automate a lot of the jobs that are currently the bread and butter of that service economy. The prediction that technology would replace a lot of workers is, as old as the Luddites. John Maynard Keynes thought that within 100 years, by 2030, we would have a 15-hour work week. So I try to say, at the top of the piece, this is not an original vision. What I try to do is to put a little bit of psychological meat on the bones and say, all right, well, what do we really think this world would be like? What would it be like in terms of what we do? And in terms of how we feel about what we do, do we really need to work to be happy?
Well, so one of the things you did is go to Youngstown, Ohio. This is a city hit very hard by the end of manufacturing. How have people there coped with losing work?
Youngstown was visited by what economists call a regional depression. The steel mills shut down in the late 1970s, sort of wiping out the central pillar of that city's economy. And in the last 3.5 decades, it has struggled to regain a sense of itself, both economically and in terms of its own pride. And so I went there to look at, what is a community that has faced the closest thing we can find to the end of work? How has that community coped? And what I found was really interesting. On the one hand, there are obvious signs of sadness. There is poverty. There are people who are still leaving the city. And even though the city and some of the main downtown areas are going through a small kind of rejuvenation, there are an enormous number of people, particularly young people, who are excited to leave and not to stay. On the other hand, there are people who have stayed who I think have dealt with this reality with a sense of resilience. And I was really interested to see how their sense of pride had evolved to deal with their reality. So, for example, when most people go to a party and somebody asks them, what do you do? You say, I do one thing. I'm a radio host. I'm a writer. I work in marketing. In Youngstown, the full-time economy has evaporated a little bit. And as a result, there are lots of people doing many different things. They're bartending, working as a cashier, writing poems, writing music, farming in a lot by their home. And so they often seem to draw a sense of satisfaction from their resourcefulness.
And in Youngstown, they got to this after some years of difficulty where people, the mental health issues spiked, spousal abuse, addiction. People talked about watching TV or sleeping. But I guess they got to the other side of this. And you introduced this concept of the post-workist life. Is that what it means, getting to the place of resourcefulness over just sitting around, you know, missing what was?
Well, on the one hand, there are cities like Youngstown that I think should make us extremely cautious about, quote, rooting, end quote, for this post-work world, because it seems like in the current economy, when people lose their job, they are miserable. In fact, there are studies that suggest that long-term unemployment is a trauma that is even harder to recover from perhaps the loss of a loved one, because one of the things that helps people deal with emotional traumas is a sense of purpose and a sense of routine. And these are the things that a job gives. And so when you don't have a job, you don't have these sort of alleviative measures. That said, there are people, as you mentioned, who have been called the post-workists, who are extremely imaginative and creative about thinking, you know, how can we welcome the automation of the U.S. economy and use it to better sort of human life? There was a great quote from someone who I talked to who said, you know, the word school comes from a Greek word skol, which means leisure. He said, we used to teach people to be free, and now we teach people to work. And so he sees a future where you have more automation, software, machines, robots, whatever you'd like to call them, doing the most common occupations, cashier, retail salesperson, office admin, food and beverage worker. More of these jobs are done by machines, and more people can focus on human flourishing, because there are too many jobs, they rightly point out, these post-workists, there are too many jobs that are just a paycheck, that offer none of the benefits of positive psychology. The autonomy, the independence, the ability to develop mastery, the sense of purpose or even transcendence that people can find in jobs they truly love. A lot of the most common jobs don't offer that very readily.
Mm-hmm.
And so we should hope for ways that we can nudge people toward jobs that can offer these things more available.
Well, I'm trying to figure out how they do that. I mean, right now, American culture is work-centric. Jobs are identities. Productivity is self-worth. It motivates us. It's a sign of status. It gives people meaning. Are these just habits or ways of thinking that can be changed?
So a great way that this question was posed to me by a post-workist named Peter Frace. He said, you know, a job is essentially three things. It's the production of the world, it's the earning of income, and it's that third thing, purpose or meaning. Right now, all these things are wrapped up together. You need people to make the world work. We have income that goes to people who work, and sometimes those jobs have meaning, and then sometimes they don't. But imagine a world, these people say, imagine a world where income wasn't so closely tied to work, because so much of what we call work right now is being done by machines. So imagine we had something called a universal basic income. That is, the government sends a check of a certain amount every single month to every single person, whether or not they are attached to the labor market. This is essentially like Social Security for everybody, and it would come presumably from a tax on capital, a tax on the top 1% or even a smaller share. What this measure would do is, A, it would give people a certain amount of economic dignity no matter what, and which seems important, particularly in a world where these working opportunities are dissipating. But second, it can allow people to reject the worst jobs, allow those worst jobs to be automated so that they can focus on things that are more meaningful. You know, there are a lot of incredibly essential jobs like caring for children, caring for the elderly, donating time to community service that are compensated with $0 or very little money. And it seems to me not entirely a dystopian future to imagine that if more jobs today were being done by machines, we could spend more time with each other. We could spend more time with our families and with our communities, and that there are all sorts of benefits that could come from that.
We're speaking with Derek Thompson, whose cover story for The Atlantic envisions a world, ideal or not, without work. Well, in this thought experiment, that's a pretty radical idea, especially now, you know, given our political climate, having the will to tax the top earners or to spread it around in a much more, dare I say, redistributed way. But there's also a lot of things that change, you know, even the landscape of the country, even the family structure. How does this evolve in the post-work world?
The geography of the United States right now, in many ways, is dictated by capitalism, by an economy that concentrates jobs in downtowns and certain suburban areas, and people go to move near to those jobs, and the highway system and our housing policy is very much rooted around creating clusters of work and then clusters of residential areas in order for those people to get to work. And so there's all sorts of, you know, incredibly bold and imaginative ways that we could reshape the geography of the country if we didn't have to commute to downtown areas in order to work, or at least if commuting was abated in some way. And so I think that, you know, there's other ways in which this vision of a world without work can be radical and even a little bit scary. So perhaps one of the most scary outcomes sort of voiced to me was this idea that you think about education in the United States. Most people go to high school, finish high school, go to college. Increasingly, the millennial generation has the highest rate of education attainment of any generation in the U.S. But we're completing these years of school in order to develop discipline and skills for the workforce. What happens when the expectation that a workforce is waiting for us at the end of this conveyor belt of education, what happens when that expectation goes away? Will fewer people go to school? Will fewer parents feel a necessity for their children to spend all this time learning this information and these skills? That's a kind of a scary thought, especially when you consider the fact that, you know, we're going to be, even if the modern form of capitalism changes over the next few decades, we're still going to be a democracy. And we have a tremendous interest in an educated citizenry. And it's possible that, you know, the interest in educated citizenry could outlive the need for a vastly skilled workforce. And that's a scary possibility to even you sort of wrap your head around. And so, you know, even though I try to invoke all sorts of elements of positive psychology to imagine how we can nudge people through this shift towards better jobs that'll make them happy, that'll allow them to spend more time with their family, there are all sorts of ways that this disruption could be truly dystopian.
Now, we do today have examples of people who give up high-pressure jobs to pursue their true calling, you know, to do their passion work. But it assumes the ability to make that choice. I'm thinking about the lower rungs, the working class members of society that have been left behind by the shift in manufacturing, shifts in working class jobs. What happens to income disparity under this model?
Income disparity under this model would almost certainly get worse. There's really no way around that. The question is, the flip side is, would the mechanization, would the automation of a lot of these industries make goods so cheap that even though some people wouldn't be earning a lot of income, they could still live lives that by sort of modern comparison might seem luxurious or certainly free of certain needs. So if you had people, if you had, you know, machines taking over transportation and you had an abundance of housing because you wouldn't need all of that office space, you know, one can imagine an economy in which things were incredibly available and cheap to lots of people and that's certainly something to root for. But, you know, that shouldn't be totally teased apart from the fact that, you know, technological change, you know, visited on the lower class often has incredibly negative income, certainly when it comes to what's happened with manufacturing, which used to be this incredibly powerful means of distributing income to the middle class, and now is only, I think, as a share of the economy, a third of what it was in the 1950s, 1960s. So it's true, I think, that, you know, both the technologists and the sort of labor liberals, I think, both have a case here, that on the one hand, there's obvious evidence that things are getting better and cheaper, and we are able to get services and products to people that we never could have imagined doing 50 years ago. But at the same time, there is a class of Americans that are falling behind in terms of real income, and that hurts their ability to afford things today that aren't getting cheaper, like health care and housing and child care.
Listening to you speak, you've really thought this through, clearly, Derek. I mean, do you envision it for yourself? Can you imagine living in this post-work society and what that would mean for you?
I can imagine the transition. I can imagine living through a period when the expectation to work full-time begins to dissipate. You know, right now, part-time work in America, freelance work in America, is sort of like that old line about computers. I think an economist once said, computers are everywhere in the economy except in the statistics. Hmm. And that's sort of, I think, what we're seeing now with sort of the part-time freelance work, is that on the one hand, we have all this anecdotal evidence that the Ubers and Airbnbs and TaskRabbits of the world are taking over, but it's not quite yet obvious in the BLS, Bureau of Labor Statistics, data. I think that it's possible that in the next recession and the recession after that, we see elevated part-time work, part-time work grow during those recessions and not fall a lot during the subsequent recoveries, so that an expectation among young people that a lot of their life is going to be lived, sort of piecing together jobs, you know, might be a reality, might become a norm. There's a hyperbolic way of saying this, which is that my grandfather had one job in his entire life. My father had six jobs in his life. I will have six jobs at one time in my life, sort of Moore's Law visited upon the labor force and job sharing. I think that that's probably a little audacious, but something like that could happen, and I can imagine it. I can imagine it happening. And on the one hand, you know, I'm ambivalent, both here, you know, speaking into the mic and in the piece, about whether this is a good or a bad thing. I think lots of jobs are terrible, but I think work is important. And I think that it's important that we find ways to connect people to jobs that are meaningful to them.
But freelancers juggling six jobs, a lot of them, you know, we have this idea that they're sitting around in their pajamas, but people are working really hard to line up the next job. Is there really more leisure time in the freelance life?
This is a really interesting question. So on the one hand, there's some evidence in the data that there's something called leisure inequality, which suggests actually that it's the richest workers in the economy, the top 10%, who are working more than they used to, and sort of the bottom 60% in particular, who are struggling to find full-time work because, you know, their jobs are in retail, where often the work week isn't 50 hours a week, it's more like 30, 35. So on the one hand, there's some evidence that suggests that it is lower-income people who have less leisure right now. On the other hand, you know, there's a growth of single mothers in America, and being a single mom while trying to work and support your kids probably affords you the least leisure of any sort of job and family situation I can imagine. So, you know, once again, it's a complicated picture. And, you know, it's my fear in terms of the leisure picture is that when people lose their jobs right now, particularly men, they spend a lot of time on the couch watching TV, browsing the internet, and sleeping. They don't spend a lot of time socializing or trying to look for work. And there's all sorts of reasons for this, partly economic, they can't afford to spend time out of the apartment or the house potentially, and also maybe shame and lack of dignity. They're upset that they can't hang out with their friends and talk about their workday. So it's complicated, but right now a lot of people seem to deal with the lack of work through a growth in leisure. And there's all sorts of studies that suggest that too much leisure simply saps us of dignity. Idleness makes us feel really bad about ourselves, even though we want idleness. It's something that I call in the piece the paradox of leisure, that watching TV, watching Netflix is something we want to do in the present because it feels like contentment. But something more than contentment, pride and meaning, always comes from the reflection on past accomplishments. And so, you know, even though I envision a future in which fewer people can expect to have full-time work, I want them to have pride and to have purpose in their lives. And I don't see a future of leisure as being a superior replacement for the economy we have now.
Derek, thank you so much. So much to think about.
Thank you.
Derek Thompson, he's a writer and senior editor at The Atlantic. You can find a link to read his article, A World Without Work, at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.
Word of Mouth!
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The number of older Americans working full-time is steadily rising. Many work because they have to, some because they want to feel valued or have a purpose in their twilight years. Producer Kate Davidson of Changing Gears found one of these older workers behind a bar in Michigan.
So when you walk into any bar, you should see one of those signs reminding you how old you have to be to drink there. You know, right now they say your birthday must be on or before today's date in 1989 to buy alcohol. Well, by 1989, the owner of this bar was well beyond legal. He was already eligible for Social Security.
My name is Tom Malvitas, born on Halloween night, 1922. I'm going to be 88 in October.
We're in the Unicorn Tavern in Lansing, the state capital, but also an auto town.
I am the owner of the bar, a working owner of the bar.
Tom Malvitas opens his bar at 8:30 in the morning, and he closes up at 3 in the morning. It's something he's been doing for more than 30 years. I asked Tom Malvitas why, after all this time, he's still working.
My wife passed away 10 years ago. This keeps me busy, and I don't lose my mind. Empty walls at home don't mean anything.
But the Unicorn and his customers do. Tonight, the bar is filled with mostly working-class men, just like it's always been. Once, there were bars like this across the region, in places like Anderson, Indiana, or Janesville, Wisconsin, places where workers stood three deep for a drink after work.
30 years ago, I'd have 20, 30 people waiting for me to open up in the morning. They were from the factories, and they were ready to have the breakfast and drinks, and now that is all gone.
And this bar might be gone, too, if it weren't for Tom Malvitas. You see, back when he bought the place, it was called the Shamrock, and it was rough. So rough that in 1982, it was the scene of a murder. That's when Tom Malvitas decided to change the bar's name and its image.
Enjoy your beer.
Ted DeLeon is nursing a drink down by the jukebox. He remembers this place when it was a real blue-collar bar.
You know what? It still is. But he took a lot of effort on Tommy's part to straighten it out.
And as the neighborhood changes, there are also new customers in the mix. Students, government employees. Still, it's not always easy. Tom Malvitas is raising money for a bar that's struggling just down the street. But he's kept the Unicorn afloat. And in return, his loyal customers have kept him afloat.
Check, 1, 2, check.
The men clear a stool and wait for the arrival of the bar's most cherished patron, Elizabeth Arten. Like Tom, Liz is 88. She's been coming in for a drink for, 15 or 20 years.
2 draft beers or 3 if I'm here for 4 hours.
A lot of people don't think of 88-year-olds coming in a bar at 9:05 right now.
Right, the band starts at 10. I dance a lot.
These customers are Tom Malvitas' friends. This is his home. As the night wears on, Tom Malvitas pulls an old photograph from behind the bar.
1926. My dad, my mom, my brother, and my sister, they're all gone, and I'm right here.
Tom Malvitas says he's not a drinking man, but sometimes when he closes up at 3 in the morning, he pours himself a shot of brandy.
So I take a sip and I say goodnight, Ma and Pa. Good night, brother and sister. And good night to my wife. Take the shot of brandy and I go. And that's a good night for me.
And that story was produced in 2011 by Kate Davidson for the series Changing Gears. And we did get in touch with Tom Melvitas, who is still running the Unicorn Tavern in Lansing. He is now 93. Thank you for your listening time today. There is so much more to hear and explore at wordofmouthradio.org. That's where you'll find your subscription to the Word of Mouth podcast. You can also sign up for it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. And if you like the podcast, do write a review or pass it along or tell a friend. After all, the best suggestions travel by word of mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott, and we'll be back with more Word of Mouth tomorrow too, here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Logan Shannon,
Molly Donahue,
and senior producer Maureen McMurray.
Our intern is Fiona Shea.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals
and not those of NHPR,
its Board of Trustees,
or its underwriters.
Word of Mouth is a production of New Hampshire
Public Radio.